Earth and Sky.
Welcome to Clear Voices. I'm Jorge Salazar. Public awareness of global warming has most likely never been higher. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a report in early 2007 which assessed that humans have been the main force in changing Earth's climate since the mid-20th century. Up next is renowned climate scientist Eric Barron, Dean of the Jackson School of Geosciences at the University of Texas at Austin. I spoke with Dr. Barron prior to his public lecture on the changing debate on global warming, which he says has shifted from what's causing it to what impact it will have on human society. It's part of the Hot Science, Cool Talks outreach lecture series presented by the Environmental Science Institute and the Jackson School of Geosciences at UT Austin. Here's Eric Barron. Dr. Barron, welcome to Earth and Sky.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about global warming and scientists. Among scientists now, what is the global warming debate?
Well, I think it's left behind the notion of whether it's happening and whether or not humans play a role. It is entirely focused on how fast the changes will occur, how large the changes will be, and in my view, it's also introduced a significant new question, and that is really how serious will the impacts be?
Could you be a little more specific with us about these impacts that scientists are predicting that climate change will have on humans, on society?
You could take just one specific example, if you like, and that is how ecosystems will respond. And you see a broad array of thoughts, but certainly risk to species, whether or not biomes will shift poleward, whether or not biomes will be able to jump over farms and cities. But if you start to take a close look at that, our knowledge of how ecosystems respond to change is really in its infancy. There's not a great deal of investment. Can you expect a biome to wholesale march across a landscape? I don't think that that is likely to be the case at all. I think the complex interaction of species could give us some surprises, and we don't know every element about it, how pests will be involved, how fire might be involved, how all sorts of different effects might be involved. And so you're capturing this notion of here's climate change and look out, something's going to happen to all these ecosystems. But yet I don't think we have the fundamental knowledge to really try to say, okay, this is what this landscape might look like. And so it becomes a very different type of problem. In some ways, it's leaving some of the climate questions behind because we're starting to bump up against the really hard problems of predicting climate in the future. A lot of the uncertainty in predicting climate in the future are going to remain for decades. And so the questions are starting to shift with, well, just how vulnerable are pieces of society or ecosystems to these changes? And then we start to realize we haven't done all the science we need to do to begin to answer these questions.
Are these changes happening now, or are these changes something that is predicted as a consequence of climate change?
So it's something that's predicted as a consequence of climate change. One of the most significant will be water and water resources. And again, here is this notion of, from a climate modeling viewpoint and a prediction for the future, that you might sit there and say, well, this area is receiving more rainfall and this area is receiving less rainfall. And therefore, you might have greater tendency towards drought or less problem with water resources. But then you start to realize that there's actually a lot of complexity there as well. Like, for instance, will it rain more in particular parts of the year? Will, as some climate models suggest, will the rain tend to come in more heavy rainfall events? And so it's a different topic for a water manager to think of water coming at a particular time of year and in bigger events than it is if it's light rain spread out over a long period of time. And I'm sort of giving you a sense of two extremes there so you get an idea of what might occur. We have some regions of the country that perhaps are more vulnerable than others. So I'm just going to take Denver as an example. You don't get a lot of rainfall today in Denver. And you're in the lee of the Rocky Mountains. You're in the dry area in the lee of the Rocky Mountains. And all the climate models for the future don't change that. Either it's still in a wind pattern that puts Denver and the lee of the Rocky Mountains, so it's difficult to get it to rain. But now if it becomes hotter and evaporation increases, then drought tendency in Denver starts to increase. But you also couple that with the fact that snowpack is going to change in the Rocky Mountains. And this is occurring because if you think about warming, you could think of the snow line as marching its way up to the top of the mountain. And so the natural storage, nature's natural storage device of putting a lot of snow in the Rocky Mountains and then melting it through the year and providing water for Denver starts to change because there's less snow stored if the snow line goes higher and higher. And it melts faster if you have warmer springs and summer, and it may not still be there by the time midsummer comes. And so Denver has a tendency towards drying, and this natural storage device for water starts to change. So now, what is the implication for that in terms of water management and how it is that you might have to have human devices to store water? So that occurs in that one location. Then in another location, climate change will bring perhaps more rainfall and less tendency towards drought. But we actually haven't gone beyond this notion of producing a map that says, here's a model prediction for warming, and now here's what the rainfall distribution is for the year, and is it more or less, as opposed to sitting there saying, okay, now here are these scenarios for water. What are really the implications for the utilization of water in the country? That's a very different topic, and one for which we still have a lot of research to do.
Yeah, what would it take in order to get that kind of information in the hands of people who can use it?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because it's a challenge, I think, because for many water managers, they have immediate problems. They have immediate problems with just the fact that the climate system is highly variable. So you have Lake Lanier near Atlanta, an extreme drought, and a huge problem. And you have water quality problems in many different parts of the country. And you have areas where you have aquifers and you're removing the water faster than you're putting it in. So in many ways, water managers have this whole series of problems that they have to deal with that are immediate. And that pushes something like climate change farther down the ladder, to number 6 or number 7 of the things that they worry about. And often in this society, we don't get to number 6 and 7 because we're too busy trying to handle the 1 or 2 immediate problems that we have.
What is the most important thing about global warming that you'd like to tell the public today?
I think it would have to be a couple things. I mean, one, the predictions for the future are going to remain uncertain for a long period of time. It's just not an easy problem. Yet, the scientific community knows that there will be some degree of warming, and it could be a significant degree of warming. It really now comes down to, I think, in the face of that uncertainty, trying to make decisions based on whether or not segments of society are vulnerable. How do you balance all of these different issues? And in my view, that means that the whole scientific community, not just the climate scientists, have another job to do in terms of articulating and doing the research on some of these segments of society, like water resources, like human health, so that we do a better job of understanding those.
How certain should policymakers be of scientists' predictions of climate change? Before they take some of the major actions that others are calling for, these cap and trades, huge increases in public spending for green energy and so forth?
Yeah, I don't think there's a magic number in terms of certainty. I mean, there's an awful lot that we do without having a high level of certainty. If you're doing an economic forecast for this country, those forecasts aren't incredibly robust, but we take action on them in a sense because we're sitting there balancing a whole group of other things and deciding on a course of action, and we don't have a choice. And so that's the best we can do. If you're in the Defense Department and you look at the risk associated with, say, another country or another weapon, we have a very low tolerance of that level of risk. I think for climate change, we don't have a very good understanding of risk. But we can sit there and decide what makes for a win-win situation. I mean, I just think the price of energy is going to go up and up. The dependency on energy with other nations is becoming greater and greater. You have multiple objectives that you can accomplish by promoting efficiency and by contemplating and investing in alternatives. You can look at areas in terms of something like water resources and look at those areas for which this nation is clearly already vulnerable. I mean, I think for sure what's happening in Atlanta is demonstrating a high level of vulnerability and forcing a plan in which we're trying to balance the interests of Georgia, Alabama, mussel fisheries in Florida, and we have to make that type of decision. I think if you realize that the level of risk Atlanta is at, it sets you into a different path of water management than they've had in the past. And I think we can start to do those things that reduce our vulnerability to a lot of the areas of natural climate variability, which I think will also reduce your vulnerability to climate change.
Do you see the scientific community as more on the side of trying to adapt to these changes or trying to mitigate them?
Yeah. In my view, it has to be both. I mean, first of all, this notion of trying to turn back the clock on the world and not have some global warming because of carbon emissions, it just can't be. It isn't going to happen. I mean, you cannot have this many people on the planet without impacting the planet. There's just no two ways about it. No one that I know of thinks that we can turn around the level of emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere for at least several decades. It's too challenging a problem, and we have groups of developing countries that are coming online and increasing their standard of living, and, you know, they may have coal as their primary resource, and it's inexpensive, and they're going to utilize it. So no matter what, a certain portion of this experiment in atmospheric chemistry is going to play itself out, and we're going to have to live through it. And so in that sense, adaptation becomes very important, and limiting the impacts becomes very important. So, now, does that mean we just sit there and roll with the punches? No, because the things that we do that begin to slow down the growth in greenhouse gas emissions and those things that promote alternatives, promote efficiency, that have that impact, are going to change the level of the change out in the future, the magnitude of the change out in the future. And so you really need to do both. But it isn't just something where we can look up and say, this is horrible, let's stop this, and let's return it back to a different level. It's too big a world population. And the cheapest energy that's out there is fossil fuel energy. So no matter what, we're going to have to live with a portion of this. So it needs to be both.
That was Eric Barron, Dean of the Jackson School of Geosciences at UT Austin, on the changing debate on global warming. I'm Jorge Salazar for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.